Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Editor with Arnie Arneson and producer Tim Barnes. A reminder that we Zoom on Tuesday afternoon, so if something should happen tonight, in fact, there's a primary in New Hampshire, so a lot will be happening tonight. We will not be discussing it until the next day. As you expect, we will be opening our show, as we will until November of 2020, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. We've actually been doing this, I believe, Ken, since March. We have been beating that drum every single day. And every passing month, Donald Trump makes me prouder and prouder of having made that decision. So I have to at least compliment him on one positive thing, that I called it right. So again, the testimony of a patriot, the testimony of an immigrant, the testimony of someone who is willing to talk truth to power, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So before I grab my guest, let me read you a series of headlines I'm looking at my Google. Historic wildfires rage across Pacific Northwest. Smoke reaches as far as New Mexico. California faces extraordinary challenge in historic wildfires, governor says. California fires bring more chopper rescues. Power shutoffs. A California fire sparked by a gender reveal party has grown to more than 10,000 acres. 50 hikers hunkered down at the High Sierra Resort, how they plan to evacuate Creek Fire. Bobcat fire threatens Southern California foothill cities. And then last, planned blackouts, unsuccessful helicopter rescue attempted as California wildfires rage on. That's just the last couple of hours. So, a couple of days ago, I saw a tweet by Dana Nucciatelli. Dana is an environmental scientist, a writer, and the author of Climatology versus Pseudoscience, published in 2015. I think you need to republish it in 2020. He has published 10 peer-reviewed studies related to climate change and has been writing about the subject since 2010 for outlets including Skeptical Science and The Guardian. Totally appropriate. The title of his piece at Yale Climate Connections: Climate Change is Worsening California's Hellish Wildfires. Let me welcome our scientists to the program. Thank you so much for joining us, Dana. And I know you live in California. So the combination of writing about science, about writing about climate change, about writing about fires, it's not something that you are sort of reading the reports. It's something that you are living. More than any other state, California has led on combating climate change. You know, it's really sort of forced the country to address a lot of things because there's such a huge economic engine that when they make change, the rest of the country notices. And eventually we begin to sort of adopt some of their changes. And yet, as I'm looking at the story that you wrote and I'm looking at all the stories I just read from the headlines, oh my God, you are bearing so much of the brunt of this horrific story that we are just at the beginning of experiencing. So welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
You start with a whole series of like sort of little nuggets of information at the beginning of your article. Why don't you walk us through those little nuggets of information? Because if nothing else, I feel like each one of them is like a punch. And I think people need to know how many punches California has received over the last just couple of weeks.
Sure, yeah. So this pretty much all happened in August of this year, 2020. So in California, we had a fire tornado happening near Lake Tahoe, We had a very rare series of winter lightning storm or summer lightning storms that we really never see in California, because in the summer we basically have no storms whatsoever. It's just those are our dry months in California as a Mediterranean climate. We had a heat dome sitting over pretty much the whole southwestern United States, including California. There was this tropical storm off the coast of Southern California that's the heat dome pulled in moisture from the tropical storm, which is what caused those lightning storms to happen. But because it was a combination of heat with that with those storms, the precipitation, when it fell, it most pretty much none of it made it to the ground. It all evaporated before it made it to the ground. And so these lightning storms were dry storms, and so we were getting a whole bunch of lightning strikes. There were something like 11,000 lightning strikes over 3 days across the state, and it was dry. And because it's the summer in California, the entire state was basically dry, and we weren't getting much precipitation reaching the ground from the storms. And so, as a result, because it was dry, because you have these lightning strikes, you had hundreds of wildfires getting lit across the state in mid-August. And so, as a result, there's been wildfires just burning, very difficult to control because of the hot and dry conditions. It's been a real challenge for the firefighters to get these fires under control. And
Okay,
so,
let me start with what is a heat dome? Because you use the term of art as if we understand it. And I need people to understand what a heat dome is, because you just told a story about this heat dome and then this like sort of a tropical storm that normally brings rain. And yet, because of the heat dome, there's no rain. But why do we call it a tropical storm? It's supposed to be about rain. So describe a heat dome and how often do they appear? What is the sort of arc of history of heat domes in California?
sure. So yeah, a heat dome is a good name for the weather phenomenon that it is, because it's a dome of heat. It's a high pressure ridge in the atmosphere that it's kind of just sitting there, and so the heat, when the air drops, it warms. And so basically it's just this region where, because of this high pressure ridge sitting in the atmosphere there, the air heats up. And so it's just kind of an area, it's a weather phenomenon where you basically get a big heat wave stuck in one spot, essentially.
So and I'm listening to you. You know what I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about the hurricane that hit Houston. And the hurricane that hit Houston was about rain that hit one spot and then never left. And now we got California and we got heat and it never leaves because it's called the heat dome. I don't think I like this climate change. This climate change, it's the idea is usually you have a storm and you watch it go by. Or you have heat and you watch it sort of eventually leave. And what I'm hearing from you with this heat dome is that when you think about it, it's a concentration of heat, but it just sits there. And that is
What makes it sit
absolutely
there?
incredible.
What makes it just sit there, either the heat or the water in Texas?
So it's related to changes in the jet stream. And there's actually another example that we had in California from 2012 to 2016. We had California's worst drought in over 1,000 years. And again, that was because there was a high pressure ridge sitting off the coast of California in the Pacific Ocean. And basically, anytime a storm system would come in from the Pacific Ocean, this high pressure ridge would push the storm system up to the north around California, and all the rain would go into kind of Canada and the Pacific Northwest, as we weren't getting any rain. And so these sorts of systems get sitting in one place, they tend to happen more frequently because there are these wavy patterns forming in the jet stream. So normally the jet stream it's kind of this atmospheric stream of air that goes across the north part of North America. So it just kind of goes straight from west to east, normally across kind of the northern part of the United States. So you can kind of think of it sort of like a river, where when a river is going fast, the water just goes in a straight line. But when the river slows down, then the water sort of starts to meander and create kind of wavy patterns because it's not going in this fast straight line. And so a similar thing is happening with the jet stream more often than it used to due to climate change. And they call these things, the technical term is Rossby waves, but they're wavy patterns in the jet stream instead of going in a straight line. And so there's a lot of research in the climate science community kind of trying to figure out why that's happening more frequently and what exactly the connection is to climate change. Kind of the best hypothesis right now is that it's related to the deteriorating amount of ice in the Arctic, the sea ice. And so one of the forces that holds that jet stream going in a straight line is the temperature difference between the Arctic and lower latitudes like the United States. So the Arctic's really cold, we're warmer down in the United States. And so that temperature difference, when it's a big temperature difference, there's a force that keeps the jet stream going in a straight line. But the Arctic is warming really, really fast. Much faster than the United States. It's actually the fastest warming part of the planet. And so one of the main reasons that's happening is because of disappearing Arctic sea ice. Because when you have this layer of ice on the Arctic Ocean, sunlight comes down and it hits the ice. Ice is very reflective, so it bounces off and it goes back into space. But when the Arctic sea ice melts, then you have more dark oceans. So the sunlight comes down, it hits the dark ocean and it gets absorbed. And as a result, you get more warming because more sunlight is being absorbed. And that in turn causes more ice to melt, which causes more light to be absorbed. And you get this feedback effect that's causing the Arctic to warm really fast. And so since
in a way it makes a lot of sense, because what you're describing is when the Arctic is ice, it's kind of like a magnet. And so it sort of keeps that stream, it attracts it so it doesn't get absorbed or bounced down. But once it gets warmer, it loses that magnetic ability. And therefore, instead of it holding on to it, it ends up dropping down so that we end up getting these kinds of changing climate, changing weather patterns, and in this case, the heat dome.
Yeah, I mean, it's losing reflectivity. So we're absorbing more sunlight in the Arctic. And so since the Arctic's warming faster, that means the temperature difference between the Arctic and North America decreases. And so there's less of a force holding jet stream in a straight line. And so you get more and more of these wavy patterns. And so if you think of a wavy pattern and suddenly some kind of weather system gets into that wavy pattern, it kind of gets held in place in that wave because that wave is just kind of in the shape of it. It's kind of holding the weather system in place.
And it's so amazing. As I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about the melting, Arctic and the melting Antarctic, I keep thinking about sea level rise. And so that's the only thing I think about, sea level rise. Now I'm listening to you and I'm getting really nauseous because this isn't about sea level rise. This is like now because of the changing temperature, yada, yada. I mean, these are things that people could say that you could point to the Arctic and the Arctic melting to the fires in California. People would think you were nuts. But as you just describe it, not only are you not nuts, but again, what I want people to begin to hear is actions have consequences. And the consequences in this case, it's like you have to do all these tabletop exercises because it's not, the assumption is it's one thing. It's not one thing. It's so many other things. And one of the paragraphs that you have is entitled, "Climate Change is a Wildfire Threat Multiplier." And what you are just describing about the Arctic is part of that wildfire threat multiplier, only that's not what you were talking about in that paragraph. This is just sort of explaining the dome. Now talk to me about what you meant by the wildfire threat multiplier in your article.
Yeah, so that was language used in a brand new study it coincidentally was published on August 20th, which was like one of the worst wildfire days in California. It was published in this journal, Environmental Research Letters, but it was basically like a who's who of the best California wildfire climate science experts. So it's just a really good paper and it just happened to be published at like the perfect time. And so basically they found that the number of really bad weather days for wildfires, they call it the fire weather index. The number of those days happening where the fire weather index is really bad in California in the autumn has doubled over the past few decades. So now we're getting twice as many really bad conditions for wildfires in the autumn, in the fall months, twice as frequently now as we were in the 1980s. And the reasons that's happening is there's basically two main reasons. One is because temperatures are going up because of global warming. And when you have hotter temperatures, it means you have more evaporation, everything dries out, and therefore you have more fuel for wildfires to spread further and faster than they would otherwise have. The second reason is because of these climate change effects that we're just talking about, there's less rain falling in California in those autumn months as the planet warms. Just we're getting these transitions and different, complicated transitions in weather patterns as a result of climate change, because climate change, as we were talking about, is really complicated. So it happens in California, we're actually getting more rain in the winter, but we're getting less rain in the fall and the spring. And so the problem is we already have this dry season in the summer, and that's when everything dries out and creates the conditions for wildfires. Well, now the wildfire season is getting longer and longer because the spring and the fall are getting less precipitation.
Exactly. It's not a summer wildfire season. It's now a spring, summer, fall wildfire season. So I guess I ask you a question, Dana. How did you get to live in California? How are you going to live with this? Because one of the things that you pointed in your article, and I was not surprised by this, how wildfires affect people's ability to breathe, what it does with the pollution and the air and the smoke and the ash, is that it affects the lungs, it affects the heart, it affects all these things. And then you think, oh, well, isn't that terrible? And you go, wait a minute, this sounds familiar. We're beginning to find out that COVID-19 isn't like the normal flu, that COVID-19 has long-term effects on the heart, on the lungs, on the whatever. So you are not in only a climate change multiplier. You are now in a climate change multiplier times a pandemic multiplier that attacks exactly the same organs in the body as what's happening now because of the wildfires. How is California going to survive this? Because even if we were like remarkable and tomorrow we address climate change more vigorously as a planet than anything possible, it would take a long time for the effects of the change to actually make a difference in what you're experiencing in California right now. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I mean, basically the result is that we're going to have to stay indoors more often, as we're having to do with COVID. We have to, you know, social distance. And now with the wildfires, because often we have unhealthy air quality outside in a lot of parts of the state, particularly where I live in the Central Valley, kind of smoke kind of accumulates in the Central Valley here. So we have unhealthy air quality a lot. So we have to basically stay indoors more, do less activity outside, which I play tennis. So it's really bad for me. I have to either just go out and breathe unhealthy air or stay inside and not do physical activity. And so it's going to be a tough thing to adapt to. Like, these wildfires are not going to go away, because, you know, even if we slow global warming, we're not going to like reduce global warming. It's going to be at these, you know, higher risk of wildfires than it is right now. And so it's just going to kind of get a little worse. And hopefully, depending on how successful we are, it's slow global warming, not too much worse.
Okay. So we're talking with Dana Nucitelli. He wrote a piece entitled "Climate Change is Worsening California's Hellish Wildfires." So I'm going to raise a couple of thoughts here. And that is that what are we going to do about the power problem? Because what we're hearing out is blackouts. What we're going to hear is if there's a fire, you may even lose portions of the grid. So how do you get, you know, your energy needs? Are we really going to look at people? I've always talked about the democratization of energy, that everyone should be their own little power plant. And after listening to you, never in my life have I thought it should happen tomorrow, but it needs to happen tomorrow in California. Because if you're going to be spending all that time inside, that means you're going to be using more AC. That means you're going to be using more energy. That means you're going to be dependent now more on your social media and all these other things. And that is going to be a shock to the grid that's already shaking to start. Is California recognizing that they're really going to have to try to figure out how not only just communities should try to figure out what to do about their energy needs, but that individuals and businesses need to begin to address their energy needs and not assume a grid, assume that they can start with solar panels and, you know, conservation and maybe even a couple of geothermal, that they need to be their own power source in order to survive what is clearly going to be happening because of these fires.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that it takes a lot of money for individuals to buy their own solar panels and battery systems. And so for a lot of people, that's just not an economic option. So on a large scale, we kind of just had to figure out the best way to address this in California. So there were a couple of days that there was a big deal made of rolling blackouts a couple of weeks ago. I think that was actually really overblown in various media outlets. So it was basically, it was 2 days. It was, I think, a few hours each day. So basically in certain regions, I think it was kind of in the Bay Area, mostly was where it was isolated. Basically households were out without power for an hour or two over 2 days. So, and it was something like 1% of the overall state population. My power never went out here in Sacramento. And the reason it went out was sequence. There was some bad planning. There was some, you know, misfortune with, I think there was some unexpected, the wind wasn't blowing when it was expected to, and there were some natural gas power plants that they were having trouble operating in the heat that we were having. A lot of people were saying they're trying to blame it on renewables, like there's too much, you know, wind and solar and not enough fossil fuels, whereas actually the fossil fuel plants were having trouble operating the extreme heat we were having because that was during a record heat wave. So there's not an...
All right, so let me also share something.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm listening to this about you playing tennis and you can't play tennis. And I'm listening to this and saying you have to spend more time indoors. I'm listening to what happens because of the air quality is going to be just impossible to function in. And then I'm looking at COVID, which is also forcing us indoors. And of course, it's, once you go indoors, then there's a potential for COVID. So it's kind of like, you know, you're escaping one to actually embrace another, which is not necessarily a good thing. So I'm going to share a story with you when I was in China. Because while they weren't facing fires, they were facing significant air pollution. And at one point in time, and I don't know whether they've actually pursued it, but I know that in Beijing, they were talking about building domes over school playgrounds. And that they were looking at building these huge domes so that children could go to school, be indoors, and then they could go outside, but actually not be outside, but there would be a huge dome over the playground so kids could still have their physical activity, but they wouldn't have to breathe the polluted air. And I know you're talking about cost, but I am listening to you describe this, and I'm seeing the situation getting worse and worse and worse. And we really do have to, as a country, and California has to as a state, start doing the cost-benefit analysis. Maybe there is a benefit to give everyone the opportunity to slap solar panels and batteries on their house. Maybe there is a benefit to going to every sort of school district and slapping a dome over every playground, because I don't see the situation improving. And I'm trying to figure out, how do you survive with anything that resembles a quality of life if what we are seeing now in California is going to be repeated for years to come? And if that's the case, then how you survive is not how you used to survive. It's going to be a very, very different conversation, and it's physically going to look very different.
Yeah, so one important thing to point out here is that when we're talking about, you know, the problem of breathing unhealthy air, and like a primary source of air pollution is burning fossil fuels. And so, like, yes, wildfires create air pollution, but so does gasoline burning in cars, so does burning coal, even burning natural gas has some. So if you're worried about breathing hazardous air, as we should be, because it's very bad for health, then like primary thing we should be doing is transitioning away from fossil fuels, which then in turn will also limit the amount of wildfire burning in California, which then will limit at least the amount of air pollution from wildfires. So yeah, we have to find some good ways to do that. And if we can get houses to be able to afford solar panels and battery systems, that would be great. I mean, one way to do that is to make sure that fossil fuels reflect their true costs, including those costs of air pollution, putting a price on carbon pollution and other pollutants, and making sure that like they don't have this artificial advantage of not having to pay for the pollution that we as individuals and as a society pay for in terms of health costs.
So I'm talking to friends who were in New York City during the worst part of COVID. And a lot of my friends have started looking at other places to live. And they've looked at Vermont, and they've looked at New Hampshire, and they're sort of thinking, maybe I need to leave the city. And even though New York has done a remarkable job of addressing the pandemic, the idea that this is the only pandemic is something that people are beginning to realize we may have a recurring situation with these kinds of things. They're also realizing the density issues are going to affect it. What's going to happen with California and how people look at how they are going to survive in California? Because what you are describing right now feels very challenging, if nothing else. And California has always been a place that people want to go to for a lot of reasons. And yet, as I'm reading about, you know, your piece, and I'm looking at the headlines, and the headlines sound so familiar because we heard them a year ago, or we heard them 2 years ago. And yet, one of the nuggets of information I got from your tweet was that we're at the beginning, quote unquote, of fire season, and we've already burned more millions of acres now by 10% than the worst we had ever burned, which was 2 years ago. This is September. We're looking at September 8th, everyone. We're zooming the day before. And if you are already eclipsing the worst number of acres by 10% now, what the hell is it going to look like by the end of the fire season? And in addition to which, I'm going to again throw something back at you at your article, again, because of the pandemic, we used to turn to prisoners to help fight fires. Well, because of the raging COVID in prisons, there are a few prisoners who are available to fight the fires. So you have another multiplier effect called the pandemic, because even people who could fight the fires don't exist today because the pandemic has basically drained you of that kind of support.
Yeah. So, I mean, California, I love living in California. It's a great state, but we do have a lot of different climate impacts. We have a lot of different kind of microclimates. So we have the wildfires, of course. We have coastal property, and so we have sea level rise that we have to worry about along the coasts. We have mountains that we have this big Sierra snowpack that supplies a lot of the water for California, but the Sierra snowpack over time is shrinking due to global warming. And so then we have to figure out where we're going to get enough water from to supply both the individuals and the big agriculture that we have. California is a huge agricultural producer state because of the water. And if we don't have enough water, then we're going to figure out A, you know, how are we going to supply California, but B, how are we going to supply enough food to feed everybody in the United States and everywhere else that we export our food. There's, you know, droughts that we have to worry about. You know, so there's a lot of different impacts to different regions of California. So it is a state that has a lot of different climate impacts, but at the same time, everywhere has climate impacts. You know, New York, they had Hurricane Sandy that hit them. You know, the Gulf of Mexico has hurricanes they have to worry about. Florida, we have, you know, Iowa just got hit by huge flooding due to huge storms, and the Midwest has been getting warmer.
And I don't know if you know about this, but we just did an interview with a guy named Art Cullen, who writes for Storm Lake News, and he wrote a piece at The Guardian. And the piece at The Guardian was about what was going on in Iowa. And one of the statistics he shared with me was that they had this flat wind called the derecho, I guess it's called. And the derecho flattened, I want everyone to hear this, 14 million acres. It flattened it. Now you're thinking, well, what does that mean? Well, that means soybeans flattened. That means corn flattened. That means in this agricultural belt where everything grows up, it was all flattened and basically wiped out. And 14 million acres is just an unbelievable sort of concept to think about. And that just happened. And that's not the floods. That's just the wind. That's just the wind. So I guess what I'm thinking about is that we're looking at this transition, we're hoping in 2020, to a different administration. It would seem to me that right now, climate change has to be number 1, 2, 3, and 4 on the list. And because of the pandemic, in a lot of ways, that is a multiplier to some of the problems that we're going to be seeing as a result of climate change. And I'm wondering whether an administration, whether it's I'm hoping the Biden administration is capable of embracing the kind of significant changes we're going to have to make incredibly quickly.
Yeah. So, I mean, the good news is that the Democrats have come out with a lot of good plans, a lot of good climate plans that are very aggressive and very ambitious if they're able to pass them, which is going to depend on who controls both the White House and Congress, both branches or both chambers of Congress next year. The good news is they're prepared if the Democrats have control. Like, they have a big climate plan out of a House Select Committee. There was a Senate Select Committee that came out with a very similar climate plan. Joe Biden has a very similar climate plan. That they're very ambitious and like they are up to the task of what we need to do. The only question is whether they will have the power to pass those plans. But if they do, then at least we have a shot to kind of get this thing under control.
I'm surprised to hear that you think that the Democrats have pretty much agreement on plans that are sufficient to deal with climate change, because I thought the discussion about it during the last 6 months has been that the Dems have fought each other by saying that your plan isn't nearly ambitious enough. If you get us to net zero by 2050 or later, that's just ain't going to cut it. So are they wrong? Or are you really believing that most of the Democrats are in agreement on plans that are strong enough, assuming they can pass them in both chambers?
Yeah. So, I mean, the target of net zero, some people argue, so the kind of the main target is people tend to aim for 2050. Some people argue we should be aiming for 2030, which scientifically would be great. And for practical standpoint, I don't see how that's even really feasible. And so that's where the argument comes from. To me, all that matters is that we implement a climate policy that's as aggressive and reduces emissions as much as possible, as fast as possible. Don't even worry about targets in 2030 or 2050. Just start deploying green technology soon as possible, as quickly as possible. And then, you know, future.
You have an ace in the administration, and that is that Kamala Harris comes from California. So the stories that we are discussing are not stories that she will not be following very intimately, because this is her home state. So what you are describing is horrific. What we are seeing on the news is horrific. they really are in the middle of Donald Trump and the USPS and DeJoy and all the lies and whatever, they're forced to look at what's going on in California because it is just such a crisis. And I think that's a good news story, because as you talk about whether we have the political will or whether Joe Biden does something enough and there's a fight within the progressive wing and the moderate wing, guess what? The catalyst to doing the right thing will be California, because the right thing will be forced on them because California is burning. And nobody wants that to happen because it's just too much of a huge economic engine. And if California is burning, we're the ones that are going to be next. So Dana, thank you so much for doing this. I just want everyone to go back to that little statistic that I read at your tweet, that we have now exceeded the worst number of acres burned by 10% already. We are only in September, and this technically is supposed to be sort of the beginning of the fire season. I just want to sober my audience up. Again, thank you. I'm sure I'll be reaching out to you again. So take care of yourself and stay inside.
All right. Thanks. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Dana Nicelli, Wise for the Yale Climate Connections. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will be right back.
Olé, 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 olé.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I love ProPublica. I go to it a lot. And I've come to become almost good friends with Marshall Allen because he covers one of my passions, which is healthcare and how the system kind of gouges us financially. We already know that the United States spends more on healthcare than any country in the world. And yet you would think that we would have the best healthcare in the world. Well, we have a lot of millions of people who are either uninsured or underinsured despite the Obamacare. We know that the cost of out-of-pocket expenses are enormous. And we're also beginning to look at sort of the results of this very expensive healthcare system. And it turns out that we're not living healthier and that we're not living longer. And I'm thinking, so what's the point? And then I saw Marshall Allen's story at ProPublica. And I'm like, of course we'd be gouging during COVID-19. The title of Marshall's piece, A Doctor Went to His Own Employer for a COVID-19 Antibody Test. It costs, sitting down everyone, $10,984. And I'm thinking, this is not possible. And then here's the subtitle. Physicians Premier ER charged Dr. Zachary Sussman's insurance $10,984 for his COVID-19 antibody test, even though Dr. Sussman worked for the chain and knows that the testing materials only cost a whopping $8. Even more surprising, the insurance company paid in full. All right, walk me through this story. And of course, I want to remind everyone that this story takes place in Texas. Now, I'm sure you remember, Marshall, that we air on KPFT in Houston, Texas.
Right.
So again, another reason for me to want to dance with you on this story, because it's about one of my biggest audiences. And what I want to remind everyone is that Texas is a place that did not expand Medicaid. So it didn't do what happened and what would be permissible under Obamacare. So that's one story. Another story about Texas is that it's the highest percentage of uninsured in the United States. So as I'm looking at these sort of grotesque backdrops, tell us the story of Sussman as a physician, where he worked, and how the hell this was even possible.
So Zachary Sussman is a pathologist, and he was actually supervising the antibody testing for this same chain of freestanding emergency rooms in Texas. He was going to visit some of his extended family back in May, And he decided to get an antibody test. Now, the antibody test is the one that will test you if you had COVID in the past. It'll test and see if your blood carries the antibodies that show that your body fought off the infection. So it wasn't a diagnostic test that would tell if he had COVID at the time, which sort of doesn't make a lot of sense. And I talked to him about that. He said it didn't make total sense, but what he wanted was he wanted the reassurance if he tested positive. He wanted to know before he went to be with his family that he had already had it. And also, this was the test that he supervised for this chain of freestanding emergency rooms. So for him, it was a little bit also of curiosity just to see what it's like from the patient point of view to get a test at one of these emergency rooms where he works. He went to the facility and he said he supervised the tests at four different facilities, not the one he went to. He goes to this facility.
Anyway, Kim, but let me just stop you here.
Yeah.
Explain what these facilities are. Because I think it's also important to understand what they are and how they're used. Because I didn't know these things kind of existed until I read about it in Texas. So explain to us exactly what they look like, what they do, and how they're not. I mean, he didn't go to an ER per se.
Right.
He went to something different. So explain what this facility is.
So the freestanding emergency rooms are not just unique to Texas, because they do have them elsewhere, but Texas is really the epicenter for the freestanding emergency rooms. And that means that they are an emergency room that's not connected to a hospital. They are often set up kind of in strip malls, in more affluent areas where there's a high population of insured patients. They look like an urgent care, but under the law, they're allowed to bill like they're a hospital emergency room. And what they will tell you is that they're a higher level of service that you can obtain there. And also, when they passed the law, I think the intent was to allow some of these freestanding places to go into more rural communities where there might not be a hospital. So I think that was sort of one of the intents. But the way it's kind of played out, according to a lot of experts I talked to, is that they set up in affluent areas. One expert I talked to who studied them said they really are a deceptive business model, because they stay out of network with insurance companies on purpose. And then what they do when they're out of network, which means they don't have contracted prices with insurance companies, that's right, they jack up the prices as much as they can. So they draw in patients, they draw in insured patients, they jack up the prices, and then they can either get paid that full amount or the amount typically gets negotiated down. And these used to be the source of these surprise medical bills that people heard about a lot in past years. They've tried to pass laws now so that the patient can't get hit with a surprise bill. In other words, it would be a balance bill. The patient would have to pay the balance of what the insurance company didn't pay. But nowadays in Texas, they've outlawed that practice. But that does not mean that they can't still hit the insurance plan with a massive fee for a very simple service.
Well,
so in this case, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yep. Because I just want people to, I wish I had a shovel, because I'd be shoveling right now that the Texas legislature bought this crap. And that is that you told me that the rationale kind of was that they would be in places where that were not served by hospitals, and
right,
these high-end ERs that do more than just a walk-in, you know, urgent care place would in part be kind of like a faux hospital. You know, that would sort of look like a hospital, do some of the things of a hospital, but you wouldn't need to have built a hospital complex.
Right.
But what you're telling me is if their model is insurance, that means you are covered by an insurance company. What we know about rural Texas, it's probably they ain't insured.
Right.
So the sell was we could serve these rural areas when they're sort of winking and nodding because they know they're never going to go to a rural area, because a rural area is a place that doesn't have coverage. They're going to stay in a place where there actually are hospitals, where there is a lot of wealth, and where there is a lot of coverage. Because I feel like, you know, people are getting screwed this way and that, because the concept was a rational concept, except if it's based on insurance and rural areas don't have insurance, they were never going there, ever.
Right. But remember, Arnie, one of the principles of American medicine is not that you actually do what's in the public interest in terms of giving people the best health care for a reasonable price. The purpose of the medical system is to make a lot of money for certain individuals and corporations that create these kinds of schemes to make as much money as they can. It's very entrepreneurial. And that is, I think that's what we need to just start to be like, let's just be real about what is American medicine really? It's a money-making enterprise that hopefully also at times will serve the public interest. But if there's a choice between making money and serving the public interest, we see time and time again that the medical system goes toward making money before it goes toward serving the public good, if it means making less money for certain individuals. So this is just one of those models.
That's exactly why I was hitting the wall as I'm reading about this, because I'm just thinking it is the poster child for one of those models, is exactly what these ERs are. And the thing that makes it so incredibly immoral is that we're in the middle of a pandemic. And what we know is everyone is afraid. Everyone is trying to figure out how to get the fastest test and go wherever they can go. There's a lot of money washing around because of the pandemic. They're throwing certain kinds of money in certain kinds of places, maybe not the right places, but there is just billions around. And everyone is afraid to say no, because everyone is told they're supposed to say yes. You know, I keep hearing, oh, you get a free test. Oh, you get a free everything. Well, there's nothing free in the model you just described.
There's no, you know, free. There's no free. There's always someone paying for it. And usually, and it always comes down to either the taxpayer or the insured or the uninsured patient is always the one paying the bill. So this is another way people don't like to think about healthcare. We are the ones paying. It's always the public paying. It's always our money. And so at the end of the day, just because someone says, oh, well, the government covers it or an insurance plan covers it, this is the reason insurance premiums are high. This is the reason our taxes keep going up and we can't allocate our taxes to other public goods, because the medical industry keeps consuming more and more of this money through these types of schemes.
Before you go on, let me just ask you, I don't understand. I thought you said earlier that the insurance companies pay the bill, the $10,000, $11,000. It wasn't the patient. Dr. Sussman didn't pay it.
Right.
But the insurance company paid it. These insurance companies, Arnie and I are always talking to our guests about how the insurance companies are outrageous. They're just lining their own pockets, and they screw us. The patient has to pay everything. The insurance company takes your premiums, but doesn't cover anything. Why are they willing to cover an $11,000 bill like this?
Well, first of all, there's no explanation for why an insurance company would cover an $11,000 bill. But the short answer is they auto pay about 99% of the bills that get submitted to them. They just have computers paying all this stuff. They're not looking closely at the charges. They're not looking closely at the codes. And so United Healthcare, which owns the insurance company that paid this bill, said that they're now investigating this and they consider it a possible case of fraud and that they might seek reimbursement. They might even refer it to law enforcement. So in this case, it may have been paid by mistake, because the charges that were submitted to the insurance company are not justified. I mean, from what Dr. Sussman said, I ran this by several experts, this was not a justified bill. But fraud is rampant in healthcare. And it's hard to know without investigating whether this particular case was fraud, but it was certainly upcoded. There were charges on there for things that had not been done. The insurance company should not have paid that bill. They did not look closely at it or somehow paid it by mistake, but there's no way you should walk in and get an antibody test, which is essentially like a pregnancy test. I mean, you know, you can see the results right away. It doesn't even require a PhD to read the thing. A layperson would be able to read it. It's not that complicated, but there's no way it should cost almost $11,000 for that test.
So how did you break down the bill? See, the one thing that's so shocking to me is this is Sussman's company. He was temporarily working for this company.
Right.
No, he's a physician. They know this is what he actually oversees. So as he pointed out, he thought he'd be comped. You know, we're gonna charge your insurance companies, but don't worry about it. You're not gonna pay a thing. As if he's not gonna ask questions.
Right. So they had charges on there. About $4,200 of the charges were for an evaluation, $2,100 for the physician fee, $2,100 for the facility fee to evaluate him. And to justify that charge, you know, they're not allowed to bill whatever they want. Like, this type of evaluation was for a case of moderate complexity, which means you have to do a detailed physical examination, a detailed medical history, and you have to have medical decision-making of moderate complexity. Like, there are rules that are laid out that say, do not use this code unless the case has these three criteria. None of those three criteria were present. They barely did it. They did no physical examination in terms of no hands-on examination. They did very little medical history. He wasn't a complex patient. There was nothing about it that was complicated. So that was $4,200 of the bill. Almost $5,000 of the bill were for a nasal swab test, which is the other type of diagnostic COVID-19 test. But he did not have a nasal swab test. And the medical records show that he did not have a nasal swab test.
Oh my God.
So
it's a crime.
That accounts for almost $5,000 in charge. So about $1,600 of it was for the test he actually had, which is also an outrageous amount, but at least that's the thing that they actually did. So, you know, that's a charge for something that actually happened, whereas the other ones were not.
So when I,
that's the thing, a lot of these charges
I framed it as don't charge, don't pay. You know, I feel like, you know, it's like, because that's exactly what it is. This is like an unconscionable charge. And that it was almost unconscionable that the insurance company, I mean, I hear what you're saying. You said in your piece that usually if it's under like $15,000, it's an auto pay. They don't even bother because it's too much of a heavy lift. But when we're talking about a pandemic and we're talking about a situation where everyone is now rushing to these ERs looking for some kind of testing, this isn't just a one-off. These are thousands of people that are going to be coming through because the pandemic is driving them to all do the same thing, which is to be tested for COVID-19. So I want people to know this isn't just a Sussman story. This is a Sussman story times I don't know how many thousand. And that's what's so upsetting about this, is that this is really about millions, if not billions of dollars that are being pissed away because they think they can charge, because I'm not a Sussman, I wouldn't know how to read it. And an insurance company that for whatever reason is deciding to pay. And that means that I am paying because it's my company that I end up paying premiums for.
Right, and that's why our healthcare costs have continued to rise year after year after year, decade after decade, with no end in sight, because the industry makes more money the more we pay. And they often answer to shareholders who they have to keep providing ever increasing returns to. And in this case, it's an entrepreneurial company that's owned by physicians. But, you know, there's almost like an entitlement in the system where they feel like they're justified to just keep taking more and more money without providing the services that the paying customers deserve. And that is illustrated in a story like this. Hopefully they'll get their money back, but being investigated.
You know what? This is not a case of first impression. You know, it's a pattern in practice. You know it. Because if they had the chutzpah to do it to a doctor who actually worked for the company, can you imagine what they do for some schlub like me who comes in with insurance, you know, who's not going to investigate everything and doesn't, you know, basically as soon as they tell me your insurance is going to pay for it, you think I look at the bill? I mean, come on, 98.999% of us don't read the fine print, let alone look at the bill. So they know that. And yet that they would do that with a doctor within the system, someone who actually oversees exactly this kind of testing, tells you how dull they are to the kind of fraud that they're committing. That's what's so shocking about this.
That is shocking. And also shocking is that there's no politician. Why aren't there politicians claiming like they did with the welfare queens, supposedly, who buy an extra bag of candy for their kids with their welfare checks? They talk about that outrageous fraud that poor folks are supposedly committing. And then these guys are stealing $11,000. More than half of the stuff wasn't even performed, much less being overcharged for it. I would think that some politician would be riding their high horse and damping out this fraud. Why isn't that happening, Marshall?
Fraud is complicated to prove. And that's where, you know, I did a series of stories last year that show how common fraud is in commercial insurance plans and how rarely insurance plans go after doctors and hospitals that are doing this type of upcoding and committing this type of fraud. The hospitals and doctors lawyer up, you know, if you're going to accuse them of fraud, and they could say that it was a mistake. Criminal cases, you have to prove intent, and that makes it difficult. Sometimes they'll just settle for getting their money paid back. A lot of times they're loyal to the doctors and hospitals because they want to keep them in their networks. In this case, that's not true because it's an out-of-network facility. But the outcome is sort of like the hospitals and insurance companies and doctors are more all working together to tap as much money out of the system as they can, because there's not a lot of accountability for fraudulent practices in commercial health plans.
Remember how Rudy Giuliani, when he was a U.S. attorney in the Southern District, he made a point of perp walking the white collar criminals out. And that's how he made his name as the high flying prosecutor of evildoers. I would think there'd be plenty of that going around of people coming after these ripoffs.
Yeah, but as Marshall says, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. The insurance company.
You know, I keep waiting for it. It's not rocket science. And all you have to do is make an example out of a few of them. But the lack of interest in policing fraud in the commercial plan. So again, you have the Office of Inspector General and you have the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI investigate in Medicare and Medicaid plans, the government payers. Mm. It's the working people covered by the commercial plans that have no one watching over their money except the insurance companies. And for the insurance companies, it's more hassle than it's worth. It's not really their money. And so, you know, they don't need to keep chasing after these fraud dollars.
Right.
I tell you, if I could come back in my life, I'm going to come back as the public advocate, consumer advocate, who basically doesn't let the Medicare and the Medicaid people do it. This is exactly would be my zone of
yeah, this is working people here.
Exactly.
Well, that's what Elizabeth Warren started out doing, right?
And did you see, actually, California just passed a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for California.
Oh, love it. So, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. It's really great. So what did Sussman actually do? Tell my audience what he did, because while he was working for this company temporarily, after seeing this and looking at the bill and realizing that they were fraudulent, that they were claiming to do things that he knows they did not do. My understanding is that he quit.
He resigned. He resigned.
So has there been any fallout? Did he contact the Attorney General's office? Did he do anything? Obviously, he talked to you at ProPublica, and I'm assuming, did he reach out to you, Marshall?
He did. He reached out to me. I had done a previous story a few weeks ago about an overpriced COVID-19 test, and he reached out to me after that one.
So a friend of mine read your story. I unfortunately had not read the last paragraph. I was so outraged. I think I threw the paper on the floor, and I went, this is incredible. I got to call Marshall. And then when I posted it on Facebook, my friend said to me, did you read the last sentence? And I said, what happened? She said, he doesn't support single-payer Medicare for all. And in fact, one of the reasons why he reached out to you is that he's afraid if these kinds of stories get out, trust me, they're going to get out through me for sure, or they're going to get out through you, that this was going to be his way to prevent Medicare for all from actually happening. Now, when I read that, then it seemed to come out of left field. Why does he hate Medicare for all? And why does he want to protect the system, as you just described at the very beginning of this interview, that is all about profit and on occasion about health?
I didn't get into an extensive discussion with him about his beliefs about Medicare for all or single payer systems or anything else. And it is a bit of a non sequitur but that is his motivation. That is why he wanted to tell his story. And, you know, I do know for doctors like him, I didn't talk in detail to him, so I don't want to pretend like I'm speaking for him, but there are a lot of doctors who want the freedom and independence that comes with the system that we have in place right now. If you have a single payer system, that single payer has a lot of leverage over the medical providers, the clinicians on the front lines. That single payer can set prices. That single payer can dictate a lot more terms of how medicine is done that a lot of doctors oppose. So I think he would just be in that camp of opponents to a single payer system.
So let me stop you there. My understanding is that insurance companies control a lot of what doctors do. That you have to check in with the insurance company before it's an approved, you know, test or whatever. And that a lot of doctors are complaining now that they are being straitjacketed, that they're not able to actually kind of practice the medicine, that they're on a time clock, that they can't spend more than X number of minutes with a patient. A friend of mine just wrote a book about having survived COVID and watching what's happening in hospitals. Tim Snyder just wrote a book, a professor from Yale, having experienced seeing what's happening to the physicians and the doctors and how under the thumb of the system they were, so they really weren't able to provide healthcare. It sounds like depending on who you talk to, The exact opposite argument is the rationale for Medicare for All. And now I have a doctor who's saying, oh, but I like the freedom. I think it sounds like he likes the paycheck.
Well, they do get paid more. I mean, and different specialties can make different amounts of money. So it also depends on the specialty. You know, some specialties have more leverage than others. The income ranges a lot between specialties. But if there was a single payer system, there might be more limits on costs. There might be more limits on salaries. Doctors might not be able to make as much money. You know, there might be more controls put in place. There might be more accountability. I think there'd probably still be ways to game the system.
Oh, I'm sure.
But, you know, and there might be other problems that it would create. But it would change the amount of freedom that the doctors have. And I think a lot of doctors would not like that.
So you finished your story, and your story is just absolutely aggravating. And Ken asks, I think, a very appropriate question. You know, is there a champion, you know, a politician who reads your story and says, I'm not going to assume that it's only one, because as you pointed out in Texas, with this high level of uninsured and these interesting ERs that have cropped up that may be somewhat unique to Texas, what you don't want is that this corruption is unique in Texas. That's the last thing Texas needs, is to see that this kind of money is washing around and the kind of quality healthcare people should be guaranteed is not being provided. So it'll be very interesting to see whether they can bring the permitting or the licensing of these ERs, because they sold it as a rural option that never happened. And now after your story, it not only is not providing it to the rural, but it's basically soaking the rich and soaking the insurance companies at a time when that is even more immoral, to be honest with you, because it's the pandemic. And I'll be kind of curious to see whether any Texas politician takes up, you know, the licensing of these ERs and says, I want a further investigation, because we know that Sussman isn't unique.
Well, they could start, you know, the Attorney General's office is in charge of price gouging. They're enforcing price gouging laws there in Texas. They could look, you know, it is possible for them to take a look and investigate this. So we'll see if that happens. But, you know, a lot of these things have been put into place by the policymakers themselves. So I don't know that they're going to be super aggressive about stopping things that they put into place.
And on that note, I just want to remind you that the Attorney General in Texas is indicted. So we're talking about the indicted Attorney General, Paxton is his last name. So I don't know whether the indicted Attorney General will actually investigate it, but that's just a little footnote for you,
right,
Marshall Allen.
Right, interesting.
It's very interesting. Marshall Allen writes for ProPublica, the title of his piece, A Doctor Went to His Own Employer for a COVID-19 Antibody Test. It costs $10,900. And $84. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And you know, I will call you back.
It was great to talk to you all, as always. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Ciao. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
We come from the fire, living in the fire. Go back to the fire, turn the world around. We come from the fire, living in the fire. Go back to the fire, turn the world around. We come from the fire, living in the fire. Go back to the fire, turn the world around. Come from the water, living in the water. Go back to the water, turn the world around. We come from the water, living in the water. Go back to the water, turn the world around. We come from the mountain, living on the mountain. Go back to the mountain, turn the world around. We come from the mountain, living on the mountain. Go back to the mountain, turn the world around. We come from the mountain, living on the mountain. Go back to the mountain, turn the world around. So is life, oh, so is life, ha, ha, so is life, ooh.